for the week of February 21st, 2016. This is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 313, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz. I wish I had a name that was easier to say.
What? Your name isn't hard to say.
It is hard to say, Giltz.
Okay, well, I don't know. I don't even know where to go with that. I was actually going to ask you whether you have changed the password on your Apple iPhone.
Oh, not today.
I hope you have a password on your Apple iPhone so that the FBI can't come and, commandeer your phone.
I've seen movies. They're just going to cut off my thumb and slap that down on the phone, right?
Maybe we should go back to how your name is difficult to pronounce.
That's right. Or we can go back to what we'll talk about on the show this week.
Okay, that's probably a much better idea since we're supposed to be talking about entertainment news, which is exactly what we're going to be talking about on this week's show. In fact, we're going to look at the worldwide box office phenomenon that has set records in the United States and around the world. No, not Deadpool. China's The Mermaid, which has the highest per screen average of any movie in North America this week. We look closer at the music business, where Kanye West is making headlines for his behavior around the release of a new album. Is it erratic behavior or canny promotion? In more serious news, music heavyweights are beginning to speak out about the court battle between artist Kesha and music producer Dr. Luke in Kesha's attempt to be free of a record contract with a man she says sexually, physically, and verbally and emotionally abused her for years. During Inside Baseball, we'll look at the changes the RIAA made in determining when an album goes platinum. Yes, streaming now counts towards sales, we'll explain. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz, whose name is very difficult to pronounce. He's going to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. And we're looking at box office around the world. We get our info from Rentrak. We have a link in our show notes. And of course, the LA Times, the New York Times, Hollywood Reporter, Variety, Box Office Profits, Box Office Mojo, you name it. And the number one movie around the world for the second week in a row is Deadpool. $140 million worldwide it made this weekend. If this were its opening weekend, they would be thrilled.
That's true. I mean, think about it. It had such a great opening weekend last week that $140 million, which is down, is still a great weekend for them.
It cost $60 million to make. It's grossing. It's just about to hit $500 million worldwide.
Wow. And that is a really fast trip to $500 million.
And I mean, the level of success for it and the level of success for this as a solo superhero movie, which we detailed last week, it's really kind of stunning. Just when you thought people were getting sick of superhero, we're getting an overload every 3 weeks, there's a new, suddenly they raised the bar again. But look at number two around the world. It's Stephen Chow's The Mermaid. This is only the second film he's directed without appearing in. It grossed $60 million over the weekend. It's at $420 million worldwide. For all the news about Deadpool, The Mermaid is tracking right behind it right now, isn't it? It's made almost as much money around the world.
Yes, that's true. But I think the real news here, and this is what you wanted to talk about, is it's $30,000 per screen average.
That's right. How many screens did it open on in North America?
35.
35 screens. And obviously, people aware of how popular it was in China flocked to the theater to see how good it was here. I mean, of course, Chow has his fans, but also I'm sure there was a curiosity factor for all those people who listen to Showbiz Sandbox.
Yeah, I mean, I think, we are the reason that The Mermaid is doing so well in North America on all of its 35 screens. I think it also speaks volumes to the number of Chinese immigrants in the United States, especially recently. There's a big article, I can't remember, it was the LA Times or the New York Times, I can't remember which paper it was, over the weekend about how wealthy Chinese are sending all of their children to the U.S.
But yes, there are rich people that won't boost up box office, though.
No, I'm just saying.
The 1% is not boosting the box office.
No.
The fact is, though, that The Mermaid is the number one film of all time in China. And I assume perhaps it will have the worldwide box office. You know, that may be pretty much the same thing, since very few Chinese films have made money in North America. It does in that territory, but that's sort of covered in that box office. You have China, Hong Kong, and some other territories. But, you know, it's just getting started overseas. And for overseas, that means outside of China. It's in 8 territories right now. It's made $420 million. 1 million of that has come from North America. I don't think that's going to explode necessarily. I don't think it's going to have big legs and make a lot of money in the U.S., but we'll have to see.
Maybe no, I mean, it's like when an Indian film, a Bollywood film, comes to the U.S. and it makes the circuit around the Bollywood communities. It makes its money all at once.
That's right. And of course, it's a partial reflection of wanting to avoid piracy. That's why they open it. There's money to be made. That's one reason. But the other is that, you know, they want to avoid piracy. If they don't show it in theaters, people will just steal it. And look, there's a couple movies that are Bollywood movies. I mean, I saw them in Birmingham, Alabama, playing at the local cinema. I was stunned. There was a Bollywood movie almost every week in Birmingham, Alabama. Here in North America, the number 23 film is Nearjet, which we'll get to lower down in the list, I think, on the box office chart. But that's playing in North America as well, the same week that it opens up in India. But The Mermaid, here's a fascinating thing. The Mermaid, if it made more money in the U.S., the sky would be the limit if it played as well in the U.S. as it did in China. Look at Deadpool. That doesn't get to play in China. If that was in China, that would have a lot more money in its kitty as well. But it's too foul-mouthed. They won't accept it. It's not going to be screened in China. It just will not make the censor cut. And so it's not going to play in the second biggest market in the world.
Now, I can't remember if Ted played in China, but I can't imagine it did.
I'm sure it did.
So potty-mouthed teddy bears and potty-mouthed superheroes aren't welcome in China.
Right, which is a shame because the idea that every film must be acceptable to everyone from 8 to 80 is a dreadful way of doing cinema. And you have to cut movies and make them, you know, denude them of all artistry when you do that. Not that I want Deadpool to be the standard bearer for adult films, but, you know, films for adults, I should say. But, you know, it's hopefully that barrier will fall as well, because Chinese people deserve to see all sorts of movies, films made just for adults, not just films that you can take the grandkids to.
And also read all sorts of books, as we'll be discussing later.
One more thing about The Mermaid. It's done it in 12 days. That's how quickly it passed $400 million in the China market.
I would imagine that's fastest ever.
I'm sure, because it's the highest grossing ever. Therefore, by definition, it must be the fastest ever, right?
Well, that makes sense, actually.
It passed up Monster Hunt. Monster Hunt, we had talked about when that was a big hit. And that's worldwide box office. And that record setting was a little tainted. There were revelations that the distributor, Edco Films, had purchased and given away 40 million free tickets to boost returns. Maybe in China, that's like me giving tickets to five friends. But it also says Chinese regulators left the film in cinemas for an unheard of 59 days until it finally topped Fast and Furious 7.
Yeah, you know, there was actually, with Monster Hunt, this was a big deal at the time because it just kind of highlighted that there was no transparency or even insight into the Chinese box office. And you might recall earlier this, or actually late last year, we covered the story of how China said, okay, fine, here's a website where you can see the actual box office.
Right.
Because there were numerous reports from all over the country how Monster Hunt was playing to sold out empty houses. So,
but what I thought that was another movie. But what I'm interested in, because I think that was another movie that was more, that was the patriotic propaganda film. Monster Hunt may have had some things, but I think it was a genuinely popular movie.
Oh yeah, it was popular, but not nearly as popular as they were claiming, and that was the issue. We did a story on it. Patrick Fonsikowski did a story on it for Celluloid Junkie.
But what I'm interested in here is the claim that it was an unheard of 60 days, 2 months for Monster Hunts to play in cinemas. Now, I knew they limited Hollywood movies. Even if you get into China, even if you get on screen, they'll only let you play for a week or 2 weeks or 4 weeks. It's arbitrary. They decide. You know, Star Wars played for 4 weeks. And you're like, well, all right, that's it. But why would they limit their own movies? Why would it be unheard of for a movie to play for 2 months? I understand how people see a movie quicker now. You make most of your money right away. But 2 months?
What,
Monster Hunt? Was unheard of for a Chinese film to play in China for 59 days.
So you're saying it's
why would they?
Too
why would
long
they get
or too
Chinese
little?
Movie?
Oh, because they have other films that they need to get on screen.
It's a hit. Why would they yank their own movies making money?
Because
no one's gonna. It makes no sense to me.
When you there's basically one distributor in China. Okay, so and I know they're
don't they want to make money?
Yes, but they actually have other films to.
You know,
that's
to
the
choose.
Thing. It doesn't matter to them.
Are they so limited in screens?
No, it doesn't matter to them. It doesn't matter whether a film is making money in that market. You still pull it to put the next one on because that's just what you do.
That doesn't make any sense.
Well, welcome to China. Welcome to distributing movies in China. I am sure there's many a studio executive that would agree with you.
I didn't know they would kneecap their own movies. Well, I thought at least Chinese films would have free reign. If you're a big hit, you get to play longer.
Oh, well, God, no.
The number three around the world is a Disney film. It's Zootopia, a new animated movie. It sort of has the B-movie slot for Disney. They used to have some movies that were geared direct to video or a little quirkier or stranger. This is not a B-movie in terms of budget, though we don't really know the budget yet. This looks like a full-scale Disney film. They're going to have three movies out this year, right? They've got Finding Nori or Dory, and they've got some other big movie. They've got the Polynesian film. And now they have Zootopia, which is kind of like the vibe of Who Framed Roger Rabbit, though there are no humans in it. It's like a crime noir movie.
Yeah, and Disney really released this movie too. They spent a lot of money releasing it. They did the junket down at Animal Kingdom.
Well, you know, this has opened up overseas in 22 markets. It's made $31 million over the weekend. It's at $40 million and counting. It's doing quite well in those markets. So that could be really good news for Disney here in North America. At number four, another movie, not good reviews, but I'm looking forward to seeing it nonetheless, is Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon 2. Is it the Sword of Destiny or the Green Sword Jade? I forget what the actual subtitle is.
I think it's called the film Netflix picked up and all theaters said they wouldn't play if it was released at the same time on video on demand as it was in movie theaters. I think that's the subtitle.
That's a long subtitle.
Yeah.
It grossed $21 million over the weekend. It's playing in two markets, obviously opened in China, and I don't know what the other one is. Does Hong Kong count as a separate market?
I believe it does, yes.
It does still? Okay. Perhaps that's it. Made $21 million. People went to see it. Obviously, it opened just after the big hullabaloo of the new year in China, which, by the way, is the year of the monkey.
The monkey, yeah.
Right, which makes it perfect for the Monkey King. But
is that what they call that in China? You know, that week surrounding New Year's, the big hullabaloo? Is that the official title?
Well, you know, it's a big, big movie going week. So Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon 2 did not get that coveted slot, but here it is now playing in theaters and making some money. We'll have to see when it comes up in North America. And number five is Kung Fu Panda 3, DreamWorks Animation, still saying, hey, we've got some mojo here. Another $20 million over the weekend. It's about to hit $300 million worldwide. That has to be a little bit of an underperformer as far as I'm concerned, given the reviews and the franchise in general.
Yeah, and I want to see it. I just don't have the time.
And number six is How to Be Single, the female buddy comedy. $20 million over the weekend, $55 million in counting. It is the year of the monkey, so hence we have The Monkey King 2, a new film, another $13 million over the weekend, $160 million in counting. Right below that is Oscar hopeful The Revenant, $12 million over the weekend. It's at $380 million, so clearly this will pass the $400 million mark. That means they have tripled the reported budget, which is another huge success story for Leonardo DiCaprio. You want to make an adult film that's not based on a franchise, that's not based on a pre-known property. You have to spend serious money to do it? Cast Leonardo DiCaprio in your movie. You're not going to lose your shirt.
Well, this was a big, big risk because, of course, the budget started to get a little bit out of control as they had to chase snow for that production and move from Canada to Argentina to find
And it's a dramatically bigger budget than Iñárritu had dealt with before.
Yeah, it's like you
And he'd never grossed anywhere near this money before, so really it was a big risk.
Yeah, I mean, when it started to get over, you know, near that $130 million mark, they realized, wait a second, you've never made $130 million before. So
yeah, exactly.
This better be a good movie.
You know, DiCaprio, I haven't really been a huge fan of the movies he's made in the last decade, particularly, but he's made interesting choices. He's trying to make serious movies, and he's certainly bringing in an audience, so you got to respect that.
Well, now, I always go back to the Howard Hughes movie, The Aviator.
Right, which I did not like.
Yeah, I mean, I never bought him as Howard Hughes.
He's an interesting actor making, you know, The Wolf of Wall Street, Gatsby, J. Edgar, Shutter Island, Revolutionary Road, Body of Lies, 11th Hour, Blood Diamond, The Departed, The Aviator. These are movies that are, you know, respectable. They're trying to make films of intelligence. I just haven't liked most of them. I liked Catch Me If You Can a lot. That was back in 2002. I loved Django Unchained. That's a decade later in 2012. I'm sure one of his upcoming movies I'll like too. So, you know, you got to respect it, even if you don't think the movies in overall have been very good. I'm saying that as he goes towards winning his first Oscar and perhaps the Revenant winning Best Picture. So what does he care what I think?
That's true. I know you loved, however, Alvin and the Chipmunks 4.
I did. Alvin and the Chipmunks 4. Gosh, I can't wait to see it. Another $12 million over the weekend, $215 million worldwide. That's why we pay attention to worldwide box office. long after we've forgotten about the movie. You know, it's chugging along, trying to get towards tripling its budget. We know family films do better in ancillary markets. So, you know, this is going to be okay, but they're obviously not going to be chomping at the bit to make Alvin and the Chipmunks 5. At number 10, here's a weird one. It's Risen. It's a comeback film for director Kevin Reynolds, who, of course, did Waterworld and Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, and a movie I love a lot, Fandango. This is a Bible epic, a Bible movie, a sword and sandal sort of epic about a Roman gladiator investigating the disappearance or death or possible resurrection of Jesus. And it's weirdly described as sort of a biblical procedural. It's like combining CSI with a Bible movie. It sounds trippy, but it made $11.8 million over the weekend in North America. So a good start, the faith-based audience turned out.
A biblical procedural almost sounds like a Saturday Night Live skit.
If Saturday Night Live made interesting skits.
Oh my
god. It sounds
gosh.
More like an SCTV skit.
Okay.
At number 11 is Zoolander 2, which the faithful did not turn out for. It made $10 million over the weekend. It's at $40 million and counting. From Vegas to Macau 3, the Hong Kong Chinese action comedy, that made another $10 million bucks and passed the $150 million mark. Here's another interesting film, The Witch.
This is a good movie.
Have you seen it?
Yes, it was, you know, a big hit at Sundance in 2015.
And that's right. And it was picked up for $1 million.
Yeah, and I was surprised that it was so little, actually. It was picked up by A24, which is this small company. They actually have a film, The Room, that is up for Best Picture. But they are a distributor that is one to watch.
Well, what do you mean to watch? They're already there, right?
That's true. So now you can just get a better view of them.
I'm just saying. So this movie was promoted via like social media and non-atypical stuff, right? This was not a big play as far as, you know, TV ads.
Correct. And it, by the way, only opened in North America.
Right. Okay. Yes. So yes, you know, but it really delivered, right? It grossed $8 million over the weekend, $8.6 million. We don't know what their marketing budget was, but it certainly wasn't that big.
Yeah, no, I mean, A24 is known for not having marketing budgets, that their whole concept is to market in an alternative way. So that
makes me want to run in the other direction. But in this case, they got great reviews. They were going to just go straight to VOD. But this is what Netflix should learn. You know what? If you've got something that can play in theaters, why not do it? It just makes it more valuable down the road. But they said, hey, look, reviews are great. Audiences are loving it. When we test screen it, we're going to give it a full wide release and not do it, you know, day and date VOD. And they delivered. They grossed $8 million over the weekend. There's some horror fan backlash. Some people insist, why are you guys dissing this movie? They're like, it's not a real horror film. You know, like, for God's sake, can't we have a horror film that's actually decent once in a while?
It's a thinking man's horror film. And right. By man, I mean man slash woman. It's a thinking person's horror film. And it isn't as straightforward as most slasher films. That is correct.
It's not a gore fest. It's tension. It's whatever.
It's like a horror film for hipsters.
All right. Number 14 is Hail Caesar, the Coen brothers. Another $8 million over the weekend, $32 million worldwide. Another North American release, it's Race, a film about the runner Jesse Owens. That had a modest opening, but it only cost $5 million to make. So when you open with your budget, which is they grossed $7 million over opening weekend, you're going to be okay.
Yeah, well, and think about it. This is a film, let's say it tops out at $25 million, okay? And they maybe spent $20 million to shoot, finish, and release this film, okay? And that's including advertising. That film will play for years on television. And it will sell DVDs in the ancillary market. And it will also probably be used as an educational vehicle.
So, and studios never talk about what money they gross in DVD and Blu-ray, which used to be more than box office. They never talk about what they make on video on demand. They never talk about what they make in cable sales and TV sales and worldwide TV and cable sales for the next 10 or 20 years on a movie. There's no updated report on what, you know, the any movie from 5 years ago made or is making or will make in all these markets. It takes a long time to spend out all that money, but they never talk about it because people want their cut of the pie.
Yeah, that's right. And if you were to ask them, they do talk about it. They are losing
vague terms.
They are losing a lot of money and they don't know how they're going to make ends meet. In fact, they just couldn't possibly cut you a residual check. Yeah, we're going to have to Kickstarter our studio because we're just, with all these, you know, ancillary markets, we're just losing a ton of money.
So we're going to skip down to a few new movies before we wind it up. Boruto. This is, I think, a Japanese film. I think it's a new release in new markets of this anime series. It's the 11th film in a series. It's based on the manga Naruto. It made $22 million in Japan in 2015, but I can't find any other Boruto in the world. Boruto means bolt. Maybe it's a new movie, but I can't find any movie of that name other than this 2015 Japanese anime film. So I'm assuming it played in some new market and grossed $6 million over the weekend. It's now at $9 million and counting, so that clearly is not a total including whatever it made last year. I'm just not sure. It's in two markets. If you know what this is, as far as I can see, the only film of this name that I can track down, other than the Disney animated movie Bolt from a few years ago, which in Japanese means Boruto, or is just, you know, the word is Boruto, this is what it seems to be. So sometimes we get a movie on the list and we're not quite sure what the heck it is, and this is one of them. It's Boruto. It made money this weekend. It's at $9 million and counting. What the heck is it? But we know what Nirja is. This is a Bollywood movie about the real story of a flight attendant who foiled terrorists, saved the lives, protected little children with her body when bullets were flying, and died in the process, and has become a hero and lauded, of course, ever since. An inspiring true story. It stars Sonam Kapoor. It made $5 million in its opening weekend, and it's playing here in North America as well as in India.
Now, I'm looking at our show notes, and I have to ask, what is this War Games thing that you have?
I thought this was fascinating. I linked to an article in the New York Times about War Games, and they talked about how War Games influenced foreign policy. This is the Matthew Broderick movie. It's one of my favorite films of that year, 81, 82, 83, I forget. But it's a fun movie about a kid who hacks into the Defense Department computer system. And this was back in the day when the idea of the internet and hacking and all that stuff was news to most of us. And it's a fun little movie. Reagan saw it at Camp David. This is what the New York Times article. It's a news article about politics. It's not about movies. Reagan apparently watched it at Camp David and went to a meeting with, you know, the Defense Department folks or whatever and said, hey, could this happen? And they're like, oh, Mr. President. And like a week earlier, he'd just given the Star Wars speech. And they're like, oh, God, he's getting all his information from the movies. And some general said, I'll look into it, Mr. President. And he came back a week later and said, dear God, it really could happen. It's much worse than we think. And they actually, apparently the guys making the movie spoke to a major guy who actually had been calling for years saying, hey, this is a vulnerability here. And he told them, yeah, go right ahead, buddies. That's a, you know, you're right on target with what could happen. You know, it's, you know, whatever. If the computer is not isolated, then it's vulnerable. And so they put it in the movie. Reagan watched it, spoke to a top general, and they ultimately put in place new safeguards to try and make sure that they were prepared for hacking and for, you know, terrorist action, cyber terrorism back in 1980. Why? Because of War Games.
Well, and if only Sony had listened then.
That's right.
Now, do we want to talk about, well, in our movie news here, we've got two different stories. One is about the Razzies, okay, which almost, when I saw the story, I thought, oh, this must be from last year, because once again, Adam Sandler leads the pack with a whole handful of nominations, this time for Pixels and for, I don't even know.
And The Cobbler.
And The Cobbler, yes. And so, you know, do we want to talk about this?
Do you remember? Well, you're already talking about it. Was he up last year for a Razzie?
It seems like he's up every year.
Thinking he's up every year.
I think it might be the latter, that I just think he's up every year.
I mean, the Razzies, why are you talking about it? It just gives attention to people. Ah, these movies suck.
Pretty much.
A cute, gimmicky idea in the film season. I feel like it's past its due-by date, sell-by date. You know, the 50 Shades of Grey. Oh, it's not a good movie. What a shock.
Well, and the interesting thing is that years ago, these were just kind of like derided, you know, kind of jokey. But then all of a sudden, Sandra Bullock showed up to accept her Razzie in the same year that she picked up her Academy Oscar Award. So One day she was picking up the Razzie, the next day she was picking up an Academy Award.
It always is smart in your Oscar campaign to be a good sport.
And she was definitely a good sport. I mean, voting had ended, but still, it kind of just showed her personality.
Let's go on to something more serious. The Berlin Film Festival. What happened there?
Well, the jury was led by Meryl Streep. And
did she win an award?
I think just for showing up, she won an award. Yeah. The Italian documentary Fire at Sea won the Golden Bear, which is the top prize in Berlin. It's about the refugee crisis, which is happening on the island of how do you pronounce that? Lampedusa?
I think so. It's happening all over Europe, of course, but this focuses on the island of Lampedusa.
And Death in Sarajevo. Wait, is that by Denis Tanović? It must be. It won the Silver Bear. Bosnian film about a staff at a hotel dealing with international delegations.
That's right. And then the Gay Award, the Teddy Bear. I just love that. It's one of those sort of offbeat on the side prizes that has gained more and more prominence. That went to the Austrian drama Tomcat and a documentary about the ballroom scene in New York City called Kiki.
Okay.
So these are movies that may very well be competing for an Oscar come 2017, aren't they?
Yes. Now, Kiki, the Teddy Bear award winner, that also played at Sundance, which I did see.
Oh, was it good?
You know, I guess being such a fan of Paris is Burning, I thought it was interesting, but not nearly as interesting as Paris is Burning.
You've already seen it.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, you've seen Kanye West, too, haven't you? He's been everywhere.
Oh, my God. I wish. Yes, he has.
Well, have you listened to the new album yet, or will you?
Did I listen to it? I watched the fashion show, and the whole time I was thinking, are these models ever going to move? They never move. They
you
don't
watched
smile.
The fashion show. How did you do that?
It was streaming online, or you could have gone to a movie theater to see it.
Did you have to get a Tidal to do that, or
no? Well,
just a live feed for everyone.
It was a live feed on Tidal, I believe. Actually, I believe it was streamed by Tidal. I saw it on some other website and just kind of watched it as I was doing other work.
Was it a legal website?
Yes.
Oh,
I mean,
it was like, so you spent 45 minutes watching this so you could hear the album, or you just wanted to see what was happening? Or
I wanted to see Kanye West is a multi-hyphenate, as if you will. He has
it's not really.
Yeah, I know.
He's not a successful fashion designer. He's not a successful anything else other than an album. This is not to put him down, but he's got all these different things. And he's like, buddy, like, focus on the music. That's where you're making money.
Yeah, exactly.
So he released his new album online for 12 hours, and then he pulled it. And they were like, no, it's an exclusive on Tidal. I guess they paid him for an exclusive for 1 week.
No, he's part owner in that company.
Yes, but why would it, if he didn't know that was going to happen, why did he release it and then pull it?
Don't ask me.
Well, all right. Well, that's why we're here. So it was a very confused release campaign. It seemed like he put it out and then he yanked it back again. And said, no, wait. You got to go to Tidal. Like, did he forget? Or I don't know what was going on. You would think once you release it online, you know, the horse is out of the stable, you know. But, you know, I'm sure bootleg copies were springing up everywhere. But then it was exclusive on Tidal. Then he put out a newer version of the album. And now the New York Times has reviewed the album as a work in progress, as that being sort of the artistic statement. He keeps adding songs, removing songs. The ones he played at this fashion show are not all on the album, and there are a lot more that weren't played there. It's just an interesting, fascinating mess, isn't it?
Yeah. John Carmenica of the New York Times, he wrote an article called Kanye West is Fixing His Album in Public. You'll want to read the edits. And he really does go back and, like, for instance, there was a, I guess.
Like, is this a demo? Is this a whatever? Yeah.
He played the album for family and friends 2 days before this big Madison Square Garden event. The Madison Square Garden event was a fashion show with 1,000 models for his fashion line. It was called Yeezy Season 3, which appears 1 year after Yeezy Season 1. And it was this big alternative way to do a fashion show. He's in partnership with Adidas. And you know, he basically showed up at Madison Square Garden. So it was a huge hot ticket to get into Madison Square Garden for this. And
did he charge money, or was it just a free ticket?
He charged money for it.
Oh.
Okay. And
learning from the Kardashians.
Yes, he showed up, plugged his laptop in to the soundboard, and just played the first song, which of course is the one everybody was talking about with Taylor Swift, right. You know, kind of takes a knock at Taylor Swift. But 2 days previous, said something even more, took a
right.
bigger
they
swipe.
Tweaked a line. Yeah, he keeps working on the album. He tweaks a line here, does it, let it there, puts in a new version, adds a new verse, puts a whole new song in entirely. It's a work in progress. And so, as is this fashion line, he was on BET saying the fashion line, he spent $16 million of his own money on the fashion line. To which I say, that's like putting $60 million in your own Broadway show. You're not supposed to do that. Let other people gamble money on your fashion show, right?
Yeah, I don't know why he would be putting his own money into a fashion show. That
right.
makes no sense to me.
But he says now he's $53 million in debt. I mean, I wasn't sure it was as
a
the
fashion
things
line,
piled
sorry.
Up this
yeah.
week. I was not sure if this was like performance art, like Shia LaBeouf. I was like, is he gone crazy? Or is this just, he's like on Facebook saying, hey, who did you reach out to? Oh, Mark Zuckerberg. Give me $1 billion. I got a great tons of ideas. And then he said to tweeted to Larry Page, hey, I'm down for your help too. You're like, is it a joke? And then in a bizarre twist, the hated Martin Shkreli?
Martin Shkreli.
How do you say it?
Martin Shkreli is he's the entrepreneur, the pharmaceutical entrepreneur who basically...
Bottom feeding entrepreneur.
He bought this diabetes, is it diabetes? I think it was diabetes medication. And he basically raised the price of the diabetes medication like
to an obscene level. Yes. Yeah. And so this guy's hated and he's been before Congress and he's like the face of, you know, evil pharmaceutical people taking advantage of, you know, how the healthcare system is set up. And in a bizarre twist, he says that he was scammed out of $15 million by somebody who was trying to sell him the exclusive rights to Kanye West's new album. He said, he tweeted or wrote this online. Someone named Daquan said he was Kanye's boy, and I signed the deal to buy Pablo. That's the album. And I sent the Bitcoin. Call the police. This is bullshit, he wrote. It's like, what? Really? This guy got scammed by somebody online out of Bitcoins? Because he said, oh, yeah, I got Kanye's new album. You want it? Why would he pay for it? Why is Kanye investing tens of millions of dollars in his own fashion show? Then he almost walked off Saturday Night Live. Apparently he was furious about the set. That was reported about online in Page Six, and there's video out there about it. It literally, he just seems out of control. But I'm thinking, maybe this is all just to promote the album.
It might be. Certainly the Saturday Night Live issue was caught, in a leaked...
On video.
Yeah, and it was leaked, supposedly. I don't know whether it was leaked purposefully or not, whether these demos that are being distributed of the album Life of Pablo, which is Kanye West's next album, were leaked purposefully or not. And that is the question the New York Times asks as well. You're right. And the New York Times makes a good... point, and this is again, it's John Carmanato. How do you pronounce his last name?
This is the episode of not being able to pronounce names.
Yeah, Caramanica. John,
which
Caramanica.
I love now. You can go to YouTube, and almost any artist you can say, how do you say, how do you pronounce? And there's somebody there online going, Michael Giltz. And they tell you how to say it.
Well, I loved his article, and he basically says, look, it used to be decades before you'd get all these demos and you'd see how
Dylan has a series of bootlegs. Yeah.
Yeah, like how the song was put together. Now it's actually happening in front of us. Literally, the art is the art of making the album.
In another more serious vein, we have a increasing spotlight on the court battle of Kesha.
Yes.
And her fight with Sony Music. And her fight with Dr. Luke, a famed producer. He's done tracks like Katy Perry's I Kissed a Girl, Kelly Clarkson's Since You've Been Gone, Flo Rida's Right Round. He's one of the biggest producers around. And he helped turn her into a star, right? She got signed by the label. She worked with him. She's got tons of success. And now she's ready to do her second album. But she has tried to get out of her contract with Sony, saying that Dr. Luke has, quote, sexually, physically, verbally, and emotionally abused, end quote, her for years after she signed with his label at the age of 18.
Right. Now, she signed for 6 albums, which Sony...
Which is very typical for the music industry.
Right. Now, you think, well, gee, if everybody is supposed to be making 6 albums, how come we don't have 6 albums from insert name of some artist that maybe their first album wasn't so great? Well, that's because when your album isn't so great, all of a sudden the record company doesn't really kind of want the other 5.
Well, of course. Yes. It's 6. They try to lock you in if you're a success. They don't have to make all... It's not a thing that they have to make all 6 albums, that they get the right to if they want to.
First right of refusal.
Right. Yeah, that's all. So anyway, she's now saying that since she was 18 years old, that he has, you know, taken advantage of her, raped her, assaulted her, done everything you can think of. He, of course, denies it completely, and no charges have been filed.
Right.
No charges have been filed whatsoever. Now they're in court. She wants to get out of her contract. Sony says, hey, you don't have to work with Dr. Luke. We got a lot of other people. It's a big company. Work with someone else. And she's like, they're not going to support my album, not going to support me. I'm bad-mouthing one of their top producers. I don't believe that they would act in good faith. I want to get out of my deal. It's ugly. It's painful. You know, it's a he said, she said at this moment. Most people do not make up false claims of rape. That happens in the movies and TV a lot, but it doesn't happen in real life very much. So your sympathies and empathy immediately goes to her, but that's not fair to Dr. Luke. It's like, well, what about Cosby? What about the guys in Hollywood you said were, you know, having sex parties with underage guys? It's like, yeah, you know what? When there's a pattern or there's a long history of stuff, or if you've got 20 people coming forward, then you can start to say, hey, we don't have to wait for court stuff, do we?
Right.
At and some point, common sense comes into play. This hasn't happened yet, but what's happening now is battle lines have been drawn and people are taking sides.
Yeah, and a lot of these people, as you mentioned, Lady Gaga, Lorde, Miley Cyrus, Fiona Apple, Ariana Grande, they've all voiced support for Kesha. And, you know,
even if they've worked with Dr. Luke, like Kelly Clarkson has on her defining hit Since You've Been Gone.
And there's also some, you know, I guess Kesha had to check herself into to a hospital for, you know, I guess some mental issues there.
You're saying she's mentally ill and making up her charges?
No. I'm not. I'm saying that's...
Well, then don't repeat that.
That's one of the issues that is brought up in stories.
If you've been physically, sexually, emotionally, and every other way is abused for 10 years because she's 28 years old, you too might need to go into the hospital.
Very true.
That doesn't call into question what she said, but it's ugly. He hasn't been charged. What I don't notice is people speaking out in support of him.
I have noticed that there are, absolutely nobody is talking out in support of him.
Yeah, and these are people who've worked with her. So, I don't know what's going on. It's ugly. It's unpleasant. We don't want to adjudicate court cases, and there is no court case in this case as far as, you know, the charge of rape or an assault. But it's a big, ugly thing, but it's fascinating. You've got top female artists speaking out in support of her. Now Sony, you know, they've been sort of like, hey, look, you know.
Keep us out of this.
She can record. We're ready to record. She doesn't have to be with him. You know, they obviously did not do it. And it's a big corporation. I mean, that idea of like, you don't want to work with this person, work over here. I have empathy with that position of the label, though I can understand Kesha saying, hey, you're still employing this guy that I said raped me. Why the hell would I want to work with you?
Well, right? And now the issue has been brought up and made so public that if Kesha does record with another producer and Sony does release the album and doesn't support it, it will only...
Well, that's I'm sure they would support it, you know, even if perhaps they would have supported it in the first place. But she's, you know, so I mean, yes, that's her claim in court partially is that, hey, look, I don't want to work with this label anymore. I don't believe that they're going to support me. My career is brand new. And so I don't want to take that chance. I shouldn't have to, et cetera, et cetera. But the fact is, I mean, now are they damaging relations with other artists that they might potentially want to work with in the future? But they've already got Dr. Luke, who's a hugely successful producer. What a nightmare situation.
And when we talked about this right before we started recording, we said, you know, we really didn't want to cover this, but felt that it had kind of reared its ugly head, and so we'd be remiss for not mentioning it.
Yeah,
we'd
want to jump in and say, God bless Kesha, or I don't believe her. You know, it's like, you know, you want to be there, and these things don't change if people don't talk about it and bring them to light. You don't want people to be shamed into not discussing it, but they're dealing with it in the right venue. And our show is not exactly a legal show, is it?
No. And you know, we did actually want to talk about the Kanye West story last week, but we did talk about it, you know, this week. You know, is Kanye West crazy like a fox, or just crazy?
And David Wilde of Rolling Stone said, "Hey, you know, I wish people would get more attention for, you know, their music and the album, the creativity, rather than, you know, what they put out on Twitter or what they're doing on Saturday Night Live or, you know, like Kanye West is doing." It's like, well, fair enough. But when you're trying to drum up attention for your new album, this is one way to do it.
Well, and that's what Taylor Swift was saying. It's about the work. The work is the big deal, not the hype.
Oh, is it time?
Oh, it must be time. That's right. I did say big deal. So it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. All right, Michael, here it is. Our first story. More groups around the world are keeping the spotlight on the mysterious disappearance of five Hong Kong publishing executives. The Chinese government has now acknowledged that all are in government custody for various unconvincing reasons. A new declaration calling on China to release them has been signed by the Pan American Center, the Association of American Publishers, and the Federation of European Publishers. The UK's foreign secretary spoke out again last week, and both the US and EU have also expressed what is commonly referred to as concern. Big deal or big whoop?
I'm going to say big whoop.
What?
Well, because I'm now waiting for China to actually react to the pressure. You know, we've got a long history. Are they open enough to where they care what other people say about them and they care about the international attention put on this issue? Hopefully they will. Hopefully they'll act. I hope people keep doing these things. But, you know, if China just stonewalls and ignores it, it's going to be a big whoop until that pressure proves that, hey, it's a new world now, and they are going to have to play by different rules when the world is paying attention.
Well, yeah, and you said, oh, I can't believe they'd kneecap their own film in China, that they'd take a Chinese film out for another Chinese. Well, yeah.
If it was doing great, yeah.
I mean, look, here's the thing. The backstory here is that this publishing company, Mighty Current Media, publishes these pulp novels, okay?
And works of nonfiction.
The one is called The General Secretary's Eight Love Stories, and it claims that President Xi Jinping of China had a number of affairs, including one with a television presenter. Another says that Xi's wife was upset over the affairs. Now, of course, these aren't necessarily true, or they're not backed up necessarily. But the Chinese government
it's closer to Star and National Enquirer than it is to the New York Times and the Washington Post.
Right, and so all of these books are banned in China.
But
they get in. And they're written sometimes in days, in 15 days, in like a month.
But as we said before, it's almost not so much about retaliation for what they wrote as different factions of the government trying to show their power and lash out against others via this publishing group. It's not so much that they cared about these books being published and being read as it is about, oh, you're supporting that one faction and we're fighting against you. So we're going to punish that publishing group to show you where we've got, play.
Right. Because this isn't the only publishing group that does this. But now all of the publishing groups in Hong Kong that used to do these types of books, well, guess what? They're not doing them anymore.
A little more nervous. Yes, exactly. Yeah. It has real world ramifications.
It's called a chilling effect. And that's exactly what's happened here. All of these executives worked, ironically, for one company. So it's kind of, the Chinese government saying we didn't have anything to do with it. Now they're admitting, yeah, well, they're over here. We have a couple of them. It's obvious what's going on here, I think.
Well, but it's a power struggle in Chinese government and different factions as opposed to necessarily just trying to squash these
publishing
books.
Yeah. Well, true.
They may be more of a pawn than we understand.
Correct. Now, sure, Michael, you can perform your Academy Award-nominated best song on TV in front of millions. You could do that, Michael.
I could?
Well, as long as you're a big star. The producers of the show, airing in March, announced two of the five songs nominated for the Golden Statue.
I'm sorry, it's not in March. It's in April. It's in February.
That's right. I was going to say, when I read the word March, I thought that it's February 28th. It's almost March.
That's right.
But it's in February. Two of the five songs nominated for the Golden Statue would not be performed on the air. That is what the producers announced last week. The artists making the cut? Lady Gaga, with her tune from the documentary Hunting Ground. Sam Smith with his theme song for the last James Bond film, Spectre, and The Weeknd doing a hit from 50 Shades of Grey. Apparently, he's not going to attend the Razzie Awards. The two artists the Oscar show somehow couldn't squeeze in, two-time Oscar nominee Jay Ralph with his song from another documentary, and South Korean soprano Sumi Jo, a Grammy winner, doing a song from the Italian film Youth. Great song, by the way. Big deal or big whoop.
It's a big deal. I hate when they do this. I hate when they have like 30 seconds of each song.
Yeah.
I hate when they have people who didn't record and create the song perform it on the show when it doesn't need to be done that way, when the person's available. And I hate when they cherry pick, well, we'll do the ones with the big stars and ignore the ones we don't care about. I have empathy. It's the Oscars. You want to put on a good show, but I'm sorry. Either do the songs or don't do the songs, but don't do them in this, don't just ignore two because they're not big enough stars, and don't do medleys and that crap. Either do them properly or don't do any of them.
You heard it here first.
Right. But speaking of music, Steve Perry's got a new album coming out. Maybe he'll be on the Oscars in 2017. He's got a new album coming out for 2016. That's crazy. He hasn't done anything like 20 years. We reported when he went on stage with the Eels, right? Wasn't it the Eels?
I don't know if it was the Eagles. Was it the Eagles?
No, the Eels.
Yes, we did, actually.
Yes. And now he's confirmed. Yeah, he's been in the studio recording. He's coming out with a new album.
Fandango, which is a web ticketing service here in the United States, well, they have made deals to acquire two other movie-related websites, Rotten Tomatoes and Flixster. This comes on top of Fandango's recent acquisition of the on-demand digital service Emgo,
which I've never heard of.
As well as the Brazilian ticketing site Ingresso, which I had heard of. Flixster and Rotten Tomatoes combined with Fandango, they will reach some 60 million unique visitors a month. Big deal or big whoop?
I guess it's a big deal, right? They're building an online digital empire. If you care about movies, you're going to come across them one way or another.
Yeah. And remember, this was the web ticketing service, Fandango, that is, that was founded by some of the big movie theater chains here in the U.S. And of course, then they went off and now they're owned by Comcast, which of course owns NBC Universal, which of course owns Universal Pictures. And ironically, Warner Brothers is the one that sold Rotten Tomatoes, is the studio that sold Rotten Tomatoes and Flixster to Fandango.
Why would they sell Rotten Tomatoes?
I couldn't figure it. I cannot figure out why.
I thought AOL would buy it. Weren't they, or IMDb, or whoever owns IMDb, right? They're all tied
Amazon?
In together.
Yeah, Amazon. I don't know why they sold, unless they just felt like, you know what, we don't really have a digital arm that can deal with this, so we'll just sell to somebody who can. We'll remain a part
owner. We'll
make
all our money now.
Yeah.
Cash out.
Well, they didn't necessarily cash out entirely because Warner Brothers is still involved as an equity stakeholder. But
well, we know it's amazing how Rotten Tomatoes has become pervasively available. It's used in movie ads now. People refer to it all the time.
Yeah.
How do you use Rotten Tomatoes? Because I don't look at it to see what the audience rating is. I use it as a quick way to, like, if I want links to reviews and see what actual reviewers said, I just quickly use that to follow the links to see, oh, what did Variety and Hollywood Reporter and the New York Times actually say? I don't use it for their, you know, everybody in the kitchen sink, you know, generic description of, oh, they didn't hate it, and therefore it got a thumbs up, and therefore it's got a 90%. Because it's a pretty broad, generic term. You know, if you don't hate a movie, that's considered a thumbs up, and that's why you get to 70, 80, or 90%.
Right. I use it for the very same thing. If I want to see what a specific critic said, I can go there kind of like Google and do a search for the movie, find their review, and go to it.
I've asked them to do a better job. They claim they have, oh, we have all sorts of standards for how we decide who's a top critic, but I'm sorry. It's way too broad.
In for a penny, in for a pound. Amazon bought a 6-episode television series from Woody Allen, although I guess it's still
TV.
Yeah, I guess it's still on television. And Woody Allen will write, direct, and star in the television series with Elaine May and Miley Cyrus. I wonder which one will play the girlfriend. What do you think? Elaine May? Damn. And now Amazon has bought North American rights to his new movie, a 1930s romantic comedy starring Steve Carell, Jesse Eisenberg, Kristen Stewart, and Parker Posey. It will get a, quote, traditional nationwide theatrical release per Amazon. When the theatrical run is over, it will be available exclusively on Amazon Prime. Allen released a statement saying, like all beginning relationships, there's much hope, mutual affection, and genuine goodwill. The lawsuits come later. Big deal or big whoop?
I guess it's a big whoop. They're in the Woody Allen business, but it's, you know, that's where money is. Boy, I'll tell you, you know, your new player comes into town, they got deep pockets, they want to spend it.
Yeah, you know, and I practiced that Woody Allen impersonation, then totally botched it.
No, you were all right. But I want to know is, they haven't, will they specify the length of time between the end of the film run and the Amazon Prime debut? Because I am assuming theatrical people will want to know.
Absolutely. Every exhibitor that plays this movie will ask that question. Period. Right. End of story. And if it's cool. Too short, they will say, uh-huh. Yeah, let me give you the name of our competitors who might actually play this. Sony CEO Michael Lynton has gone back to the future. Sure, that's a Universal film, but how else can we describe a studio chief who has responded to the hacking attack on his own studio by faxing memos? That's right. Every day, Lynton writes out memos by hand and faxes them to key people. In an unrelated note, Sony is hiring secretaries to type out memos on pieces of paper, and the studio is building a carrier pigeon coop on top of their corporate headquarters in Culver City. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, right? Is this the way to respond to a technology attack?
You know, in all fairness, Michael Lynton did say, in the midst of all those emails flying back and forth before the hack, he did actually say, why are you having this conversation on email? This was before the hack. Like, he knew,
but
okay.
No, we don't have to go back to, you know, meeting in person and writing with a quill pen, you know? Better security measures is what you need, right? Passwords that change daily, that are automated and generic. You know, things that you can do, encryption of your database so that people who break in can't just, you know, isn't that what the proper response should be, not to go back to the 1800s?
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, although it's interesting. I wonder how the people who he's faxing actually have fax machines.
Yeah, I mean, you know, exactly.
I've noticed on business cards, the fax number is pretty much going away.
Of course. Why the hell would anybody include it anymore?
Yeah, I don't ask me. I see it included every now and again. I do remember while working for Creative Artists Agency in the mid to late 90s, you couldn't fax anything yourself. You had to put it in a fax bin, and it was faxed by the trainees and then was returned to you. So there was like a fax room because they wanted to make sure that you weren't faxing out confidential information. And you always had to look at the paper that was returned to see whether it was actually faxed, there would be like a little blue X in the corner to show, sure, to show, yes, it had gone through the fax machine.
Cool. And been received. Yeah.
Yeah. The Eurovision Song Contest has just made a big change to how voting is revealed. New rules, the most substantial since 1975, mean each country's jury vote will be revealed territory by territory. But the audience vote for the entire EU won't be displayed until the finale. This will prevent viewers realizing which song is the overwhelming favorite before the show reaches its finale. In past years, block voting has meant the final 20 minutes or so of the contest are kind of like tension-free once everyone realizes who the champ is actually going to be. Now, the hope is that the suspense will be maintained right up to the end. That is, if you care at all. Big deal or big whoop?
I guess it's a big whoop, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it shows how little I knew about how they revealed. I'm like, well, jury voting? Audience? I didn't know there was jury voting.
Yeah, it happens every year during the Cannes Film Festival.
Yes, no, like, I've often enjoyed watching it, especially when I'm in Europe. It's fun and silly, but there you go.
Well, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And here's how this week's story will affect you. It means that you might be hearing the word platinum-selling artist or gold-selling artist a little bit more, and here's why.
Fair enough. That really has disappeared from the vernacular. Albums are not going gold or platinum anymore.
Correct.
They really aren't. It's unbelievable.
But the RIAA is bowing to the reality that people are listening to music but not paying for it. And the RIAA is the Recording Industry Association of America. They are adding streaming to how they measure when an album has reached gold, which is 500,000 sales, and platinum, which is 1 million sales. They've determined that, and here's where things start to get a little interesting, they've determined 1,500 streams is the equivalent of 10 tracks purchased, which is the equivalent of one album.
So if you stream Adele, stuff from Adele's new album, 1,500 times, that will count as one equivalent to one album sale.
Correct.
Now, so the 1 billion plays of Hello divided by 1,500 will equal however many.
Correct.
Tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of album sales.
Yes. Now, okay, this announcement came with a list of acts that are now certified gold or platinum and beyond, ranging from Coldplay, Kendrick Lamar, they both went platinum with their new albums, to Michael Jackson hitting 32 million copies. I don't know what album.
That would be Thriller.
Yeah.
So this is interesting. Obviously, we empathize. People are listening to music. They haven't stopped listening to music. They consume music in massive numbers of ways on Vimeo and video and YouTube and streaming on all these different services. And they want to reflect
that. I'm going to look that one up. Vimeo. How do you spell that? You mean Vivo?
Oh, Vivo. I always say Vimeo is another one.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, Vimeo. Yes, they do that too.
Vimeo, Vivo, blah, blah, blah.
YouTube, yeah.
So we empathize, right? They want to reflect the popularity of all this music that's being listened to in one way or another.
Correct.
But is this the way to do it?
Well, here's the problem that I have with this is that when you say...
I have 20.
Well, I know you have 20, but my big problem is that when you're counting something and you're counting an action. Somebody went out and purchased an album. They had to make behavioral economic decisions. Okay?
Oh, God. They spent money on the album.
Right. Whereas I stream a lot of albums and a lot of music that I would never in a million years purchase. It's a completely different decision process. However,
but you do spend $15 a month to have access to do that.
Or nine, yes.
Or nine.
But when you look at a gold or a platinum album, it means that basically 500,000 people went out there and purchased that album and made that decision. Now it's not going to mean that at all. So it will actually depend. You'll have to figure out when an album was released to figure out what it is you're looking at. It's kind of like the whole, in the U.S., we had this steroid scandal, right, with the baseball players.
So oh, that's kind of, confusing. Okay.
Yeah, well, but it's kind of like the records that were made with performance-enhancing drugs versus the records that were broken without performance-enhancing drugs. How do you compare them?
Right. I mean, they changed in the past. They used to say a double album. If you bought Pink Floyd's The Wall, that was an album sale. Then at one point they said, you know what? There are two discs in that album. You know, there are two CDs. We're going to count that as two album sales. And I'm like, oh, son of a bitch. And now when you try to look up, you know, sales for albums like Pink Floyd, The Wall, or any other double album, you're not sure what they're telling you. If it's 32 million copies, does that mean they sold 16 million copies? Or does it mean they sold like 25 because some of them were before this rule change and others came out? So suddenly you don't know what it means when it says that Pink Floyd's The Wall has gone, for example, I don't even know, but say 20 times platinum. You don't know whether that means 10 million album sales or 14 or 12 or 20. You know, it's confusing and it doesn't help anybody. But let's go back to singles. This began with music. How does a song become the number one song on the Billboard chart? It was always a combination of radio play and sales.
Okay.
And they're always fiddling with, not always, I shouldn't say that, because I'm sure back in the 50s and 40s and 30s, it was different. It was probably sheet music sales combined with something else. But in the modern era, that's what it was. And that made sense, right? You're trying to determine the popularity of a song. Somebody goes and buys it. Okay. Somebody plays it on the radio.
So you're just saying that basically my concern here is, hey, look, you're looking at maybe albums sold in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And when you compare them to albums sold in the 40s, 50s, and 60s.
I think that's perfectly valid. But I'm just saying we understand this changed for singles and popularity of singles. But it made sense because the popularity of a single hitting number one wasn't always just pure sales. It was a combination of listening on the radio. Okay. And ultimately they added in, they said, hey, look, people now play videos online. YouTube, that's an active choice, unlike a radio station choosing to play it. But for the listener, that's an active choice. But that should probably go into the mix too. So they've all been filling with that formula of how much should they weight a video play on YouTube versus a radio play versus streaming service where it's not on demand versus a sale of a single. And all of that goes into a formula to determine what is the number one song in the country. And that makes sense, right?
Right. So where are you headed?
It's a combination of stuff. But for album sales, there's nothing except a sale.
Yeah, I agree with you. Right. Now,
it's apples and oranges. If you want to make a chart, and I don't like all these vague new metrics people come up with, but hey, if you want to make up a chart of streaming popularity, go knock yourself out. But that's not an album sale. And plus, the way they've done it is crazy. First of all, they say 10 tracks is the equivalent to one album. I don't know what world they're living in. Look at the top five albums of the year, the albums nominated for Grammy. Alabama Shakes, 12 tracks. Taylor Swift, 13 tracks. Chris Stapleton and The Weeknd, 14 tracks. And Kendrick Lamar, 16 tracks.
Now you and I kind of had a quick discussion about this before we recorded. And right. I was wondering whether the RIAA said, okay, let's look at all the albums released over the last 10 years and get an average. And it just happened to be 10. And much like whenever people in California hear the average price of gas is, you know, like $1.50, we always say, where in the world is it $1.50? But yeah, we're at one end of the spectrum, right? Whereas jazz albums might have three tracks on them. They're each 15 minutes long. But, you know, and that kind of brings the average down. Of course, it very well may be that the RIAA just said 10's a nice round number.
I think that's more likely what they did. It's very hard for them to even track all the albums that are released in a year. But if you're talking about full-length albums, which is what we're talking about for album sales, as opposed to EPs and whatever, and this whole new digital world, and of course there's different versions in different countries. Japan always demands a unique track. So, you know, it's very complicated, but 10 does not strike me as remotely appropriate.
Okay,
but
so
again, that's the nonsense of saying 10 random tracks being streamed from Adele's new album somehow constitutes, you know, one album. That's how crazy it is, right? So they're saying 1,500 streams of music from Adele's new album is equal to one album sale.
Now, I wonder in Europe and in Asia and in Australia whether they have, you know, they must do platinum, gold. You know,
oh, they do. Absolutely. Every country does. Most every country has their own standard for what constitutes gold and platinum. You know, it's different in the UK, of course, than it is in the US. In the US, nowadays, if you sell 500,000 copies of an album, you've gone gold. And if you sell 1 million copies of an album, you've gone platinum, assuming you're not a double or triple album.
Okay. Well, so what you're saying is the RIAA had an issue before with counting record sales, and now they still have other issues that they have created themselves.
And how do they determine the streaming? Who does the streaming? Are they able to do that country by country, territory by territory?
Yes, they can, because tracks are, you know, they're licensed differently in each territory. So Spotify can say, you know, in America, here's, or North America, in the US and Canada, here are the tracks that were played on that service. So it's very easy to keep track of.
That is reflecting the actual streams in that territory. I was wondering if they were going to have some sort of worldwide standard suddenly.
Here's
what I want to know. Why don't they just track actual streams of Adele's new album? Maybe you pick a number like 75%. When a unique user, or maybe just add them all up, when 75% of the album or 80% or 65% or whatever metric they decide on that, you don't have to play every single track. But once a significant majority of the album has been streamed one time, whether it's me playing the whole thing straight through or somebody else playing three or four or five tracks and somebody else playing Hello a billion times, you want to add up 75% of the album hits is streamed.
Well, that's really easy. Here's how you do that. You take all the tracks on that album on, what is it, 25?
I'm sure it's easy, but I'm saying, why don't they use that as the metric?
What is the lowest number of times a song or a track from that album has been played? If it's 50 million times, okay, then it's basically 50 million divided by 1,500.
But it's not, because that maybe only four tracks in the album have been played at all. When Gangnam Style...
Meaning you take all the tracks on the album and you see the lowest number that has been streamed. So there might be, you know, one that has only been streamed a million times, in which case the album sales would be a million divided by 1500. Right. Correct.
Right. Which they would hate because it would show I'm empathetic with the idea that maybe you play most of the album, but not all of it. That's why I suggested maybe you say 70 rather than that strict, you know, maybe somebody doesn't play the last track or whatever.
Right.
They play three quarters of it, or they, you know, play their favorite five songs. But then when you've got the whole album, you've got 13 tracks or 12 tracks, and you've played eight or nine of them.
We're not going to solve this right now.
Yeah, well, we are. But I'm just saying, that seems to me, hey, that's been an album play, has been streamed. And that would be fine to designate, hey, this album has been streamed 14 million times or 800,000 times. I still don't think that should constitute an album sale. But at least it would reflect, it would be a cool metric, and it would reflect what actually happened and would reflect the whole album. The idea that two tracks can be hugely popular and then suddenly now the album has 50,000 sales because of that is stupid.
Well, you know, when the artist starts saying, well, if you're going to count it as a sale, I'm going to count it as a sale. Pay me.
Well, yeah, they get a tenth of a bit. Yeah, they want it. You're right. Gold and platinum is a promotional trick. It's just a thing to say, hey, look, this album is popular.
Correct.
And if you want to reflect that people are listening to music, and streaming is where a lot of it's happening. It's not in physical sales, but do it right. This, where you just dump every stream, even if it's just one song, not, you know, 90% of the album has never been played, is stupid. It's not been well thought out. 10 tracks does not equal an album. Streaming one song a billion times does not equal 50,000 sales of an album. It's just everything about it is poorly thought out.
Well, you know, it was thought out quite well, Michael, was the book To Kill a Mockingbird, which we talked about just last week, in fact, when we discussed how Scott Rudin, the producer, is taking that book and translating it to Broadway with a script from Aaron Sorkin. And, you know, we talked about how last year's book, Ghost at a Watchman by Harper Lee.
Best-selling book of the year.
Yeah, we thought, you know, we didn't think it really should have been published. This was a book that, you know, Harper Lee was getting up there in years, and we didn't think she had all of her faculties about her or even knew that it was published. And we certainly weren't sure about whether this whole Broadway production, even though there has been productions of To Kill a Mockingbird in the past, but they weren't Broadway productions, that's for sure. And you said, look, at the end of the day, it's not going to matter in 5 years. You know, it wouldn't have mattered in 5 years anyway, because the estate would have been handling it. And sure enough,
this all would have happened. It just would have been nicer if it happened after she died.
And sure enough, this week she did pass away at the age of 89.
That's right. So, you know, it's frankly, I think, good news for Scott Rudin. Isn't that a cold, cruel thing to say? But they won't have to answer a lot of questions about, when did you speak to her? Was she in her right mind? Did she know what was going on? Why did she never approve of one before? Why suddenly now? You know, et cetera, et cetera. So frankly, for them, it's a big headache that they don't have to worry about.
Right. I mean, she spent her final years in an assisted living facility. She wrote one book, To Kill a Mockingbird, and that was it. She, you know, shunned the limelight. She was friends, as you mentioned to me, Michael, with Truman Capote, grew up with Truman Capote, helped him write In Cold Blood. There's some conspiracy theory saying that he wrote To Kill a Mockingbird, or at least.
Yeah,
hope.
Which is truly, truly galling, since she didn't get the proper credit she felt for what she contributed to In Cold Blood.
Right.
So, and they had a falling out because he was so jealous because she was the first one to break out, and she had the Pulitzer Prize and worldwide acclaim of the sort one rarely ever sees.
Right. Now, of course, Truman Capote, you know, also had
quite a damn good career, too. Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
But they never made up. Yeah.
They never made up. And he passed away a long time ago.
Yeah, well, he lived a hard, fun life, I guess.
And hard and fun. Yes, correct.
So Harper Lee is dead. To Kill a Mockingbird sold some 40 million copies. It was staged every year as a play in Monroeville. It was sort of more of a transcript of the book when they sort of reenacted the book rather than a proper full stage production. But that version has played in community theater regionally around the country. But as far as a proper adaptation, the way the movie was, I believe this is the first time, and now it's coming to Broadway, and she can rest in peace. And, you know, some fun things came out. She was a big fan of Bloom County.
Yes, yeah.
The New York Times had this thing. Berkeley Breathitt apparently had a pen pal relationship with her, and he released four or five letters that were not of any particular personal nature, and her and his back and forth. It was very sweet and fun to see.
And for those outside the country who may not know this, Bloom County is a comic strip in the newspaper. It was a bad week for authors and for the literary scene. Umberto Eco died at the age of 84. He was an author, and he studied semiotics. Do you know what that is, Michael?
I always look it up and I always forget.
It's the study of signs in language and culture.
Fascinating. And not the usual source of popular blockbusters, but he wrote The Name of the Rose, and out of nowhere, it became a massive hit. And he wrote other books after that, and none of them came close.
Yeah, not at all. And, you know, the thing is, and I've tried
if
to
he'd
make
it... only published one book, like Harper Lee, he would have been even more acclaimed. But he was a good academic. Some of his other books have their adherents, and, you know, they certainly sold money, just not the name of the level that The Name of the Rose did.
Yeah, he wrote 20 nonfiction books as well, nonfiction academic books, and one might even say his fiction books were academic because there were whole chapters that went off on tangents.
Unlikely bestsellers, let's put it
yes,
that way.
Yes, exactly.
I have a friend. I'm a friend in her house, and she has Foucault's Pendulum.
Yes.
On her bookshelf. Hasn't read it.
Yeah.
I said, is it any good? She said, I haven't read it.
Yeah, I wonder how many people have.
Right. And also here in New York, Warren Manzi died. He's the author of the longest running play in off-Broadway history. This little baby is just fascinating. A few years ago, there was a story about it reaching some new level. It's called Perfect Crime, and it passed some new status as far as long-running plays in New York. And I was like, what the heck is Perfect Crime?
It's a biblical procedural.
Yeah, it's a thriller. It's run for almost 29 years. It has the same leading lady that it opened with, Catherine Russell. Can you imagine? That's a career. She's missed like four performances, all for weddings, basically, or maybe a funeral in there too. And she's going to have a day off for her own wedding coming soon again, I think. Or that was one of them. I forget. But it opened. It got poor reviews, but it kept running. And then now it's just running because, like Mousetrap, it's running. So people got to see it because it's been running so long. And he wrote it while he was an understudy for Tim Curry in the play Amadeus on Broadway. So that was making good use of your offstage time. He died of pneumonia. It's a fascinating little quirky bit of New York history, and we've got a link in our show notes.
Now that wraps up today's show, and of course you can subscribe to the show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. We do urge you to rate and review the show in those podcast aggregators. It does help us out. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to subscribe to the show, ways to contact us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. All that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. Or you can follow us on Twitter, where our username is @ShowbizSandbox. You can like our Facebook page. Just search for Showbiz Sandbox, and our page should come up. Again, showbizsandbox.com is our website. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on, well, I guess MySpace, which was sold last week, again, or on their website.
Did we buy it?
We did not buy it, although I think we have enough money between us from doing the show here to have purchased it. They also have a website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website.
You make money on the show?
Oh, hey, Michael, what's your website this week?
My website this week is it's Giltz, not Glitz. Think guilt with a Z.com.
And actually, that should be one of your websites. But if you can't find any of Michael Giltz's writing on that particular website, why not try, I don't know, the Huffington Post, where you can find some of his coverage of the entertainment industry, or head on over to michaelgiltz.com, and that is Giltz, like guilt with a Z. And, you know, that's where a lot of Michael's work is aggregated. You can also head on over to bookfilter.com to find out what books you should be reading. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.